On this sixth day of April, 2011, in San Diego, we are reading from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And we are in chapter 2, the contents of the Gita summarized, text number 13.
I think we didn't do 12.
We didn't do 12.
Because we got a chance to read the purport, but we didn't get any chance to discuss it.
Okay, let's do 12 again. Natve vaham jatunasam.
Natve vaham jatunasam.
Natvam neme janadipaha.
Natvam neme janadipaha.
Nachaiva nabhavishyama.
Nachaiva nabhavishyama.
Sarve vayamatakparam.
Sarve vayamatakparam.
Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Purport. In the Vedas, in the Katha Upanishad, as well as in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, it is said that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the maintainer of innumerable living entities in terms of their different situations, according to individual work and reaction of work. That Supreme Personality of Godhead is also, by His plenary portions, alive in the heart of every living entity. Only saintly persons who can see within and without the same Supreme Lord can actually attain to perfect and eternal peace. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yo vidadati kamam tamatmastam yena pasyanti diras te sham shanti shasvadine taresham. Katha Upanishad 2.2.13. So the translation of that verse is in the previous paragraph. The same Vedic truth given to Arjuna is given to all persons in the world who pose themselves as very learned, but actually have but a poor fund of knowledge. The Lord says clearly that He Himself, Arjuna, and all the kings who are assembled on the battlefield are eternally individual beings, and that the Lord is eternally the maintainer of the individual living entities, both in their conditioned and in their liberated situations. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the supreme individual person, and Arjuna, the Lord's eternal associate, and all the kings assembled there are individual eternal persons. It is not that they did not exist as individuals in the past, and it is not that they will not remain eternal persons. Their individuality existed in the past, and their individuality will continue in the future without interruption. Therefore, there is no cause for lamentation for anyone. The Mayavadi theory that after liberation, the individual soul, separated by the covering of Maya or illusion, will merge into the impersonal Brahman and lose its individual existence, is not supported herein by Lord Krishna, the Supreme Authority. Nor is the theory that we only think of individuality in the conditioned state supported herein. Krishna clearly says herein that in the future also, the individuality of the Lord and others, as it is confirmed in the Upanishads, will continue eternally. This statement of Krishna's is authoritative because Krishna cannot be subject to illusion. If individuality were not a fact, then Krishna would not have stressed it so much, even for the future. The Mayavadi may argue that the individuality spoken of by Krishna is not spiritual but material. Even accepting the argument that the individuality is material, then how can one distinguish Krishna's individuality? Krishna affirms His individuality in the past and confirms His individuality in the future also. He has confirmed His individuality in many ways, and impersonal Brahman has been declared to be subordinate to Him. Krishna has maintained spiritual individuality all along. If He is accepted as an ordinary conditioned soul in individual consciousness, then His Bhagavad Gita has no value as authoritative scripture. A common man with all the four defects of human frailty is unable to teach that which is worth hearing. The Gita is above such literature. No mundane book compares with the Bhagavad Gita. When one accepts Krishna as an ordinary man, the Gita loses all importance. The Mayavadi argues that the plurality mentioned in this verse is conventional and that it refers to the body. But previous to this verse, such a bodily conception is already condemned. After condemning the bodily conception of the living entities, how was it possible for Krishna to place a conventional proposition on the body again? Therefore, individuality is maintained on spiritual grounds and is thus confirmed by great acharyas like Sri Ramanuja and others. It is clearly mentioned in many places in the Gita that this spiritual individuality is understood by those who are devotees of the Lord. Those who are envious of Krishna as the supreme personality of Godhead have no bona fide access to the great literature. The non-devotee's approach to the teachings of the Gita is something like that of a bee licking on a bottle of honey. One cannot have a taste of honey unless one opens the bottle. Similarly, the mysticism of the Bhagavad Gita can be understood only by devotees, and no one else can taste it, as it is stated in the fourth chapter of the book. Nor can the Gita be touched by persons who envy the very existence of the Lord. Therefore, the Mayavadi explanation of the Gita is a most misleading presentation of the whole truth. Lord Chaitanya has forbidden us to read commentations made by the Mayavadis and warns that one who takes to such an understanding of the Mayavadi philosophy loses all power to understand the real mystery of the Gita. If individuality refers to the empirical universe, then there is no need of teaching by the Lord. The plurality of the individual soul and the Lord is an eternal fact, and it is confirmed by the Vedas as above mentioned. Om Ajnana Timurandasya Jnanandana Shalakya Chukshu Unmiditam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, this verse is often used, as Srila Prabhupada uses it here in the purport, to combat the Mayavadi idea. The Mayavadi idea is that the diversity that we see, Prabhupada's famous variegatedness, is all an illusion. This famous phrase, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. Jagan Mithya. Jagan Mithya. So Jagat means this world, this universe, with all of its varieties of individuals and things and all the colors and everything. All of that is false. It doesn't really exist. And the only thing that exists is Brahman. But Brahman has no varieties. Brahman is undifferentiated. And that's the Supreme Absolute Truth. Now, we ourselves are Brahman, right? We're Aham Brahmasmi, we're spirit. That's understood. So, since Brahman is this one, the only reason why we have our individuality is because we're covered by illusion. We're covered by avidya, or ignorance. Once that avidya is removed, then we will realize that we are Brahman. We merge into the Supreme Brahman, and our long sojourn in the material world of suffering is over.
The problem is that avidya then becomes like an independent devil that can overcome Brahman.
Yes, there's all kinds of ways in which this is false. And this verse is actually a very strong refutation of that. Because here, accepting Krishna, in the latter part of this purport, Prabhupada invokes the authority of Krishna. In other words, if you're not willing to accept Krishna as an absolute authority, then there's no point in even reading the Gita. So he's an absolute authority, and here what he says is very clear. He says that never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, though all these kings. And we shall exist in the future. So what does it mean to say that, what's the point of even saying that I exist, and they exist, and you exist, instead of just saying we all exist, in the absolute sense in Brahman, and there's no individuality. To make the distinction between I and you and we, then that's talking about individuality. And Prabhupada would also quote this 15:7, is it? Mamai Vangsho Jiva Loki Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, where Krishna declares directly there that all the living entities in this world, in this Jiva Loka, are my Ansha, Sanatana. Now, that Sanatana doesn't just mean that they're eternal. It means that they're eternally Ansha. This is how our acharyas have explained it. So Ansha is a little minute part of the whole. But we're eternally minute. We will never become the infinite. That's the whole idea here. Yes, this is from the Upanishads, that there's one eternal living entity. We discussed this yesterday. among all the uncounted living entities, eternal living entities, who is supplying the necessities for all the others. There can only be one who does that, right? And that's the Supreme Person. And as Prabhupada translates in the previous paragraph, only saintly persons can see that the dhiras, can see that within and without, and can actually attain perfect and eternal peace. So we become restless and lack peace when we hanker for things that are temporary and that factually belong to the Lord. This is described by Prahlad, where he says to his father, Tat sadu munye asudavada asuyabarya dehinam sada samudmigna diyama sadgrahat. The word dehinam, which will appear in the next verse, dehinaha, different case, means the living entity, that which he who dwells in the body, right, within dehina. So, sada samudmigna diyama sadgrahat, the intelligence is always udvigna, disturbed, because his asat grahat, he's grabbing on, holding on to, claiming proprietorship of the temporary, the impermanent. So when one recognizes the Lord for who He is, that He is our supreme shelter, our provider, and everything belongs to Him, one can actually attain peace. Real peace is attainable only by giving up all material desires. That's Lord Chaitanya declares that, you know, bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakale ashanta krishna bhakta nishkama ateva ashanta. It's actually reversed. The first line is krishna bhakta nishkama. So nishkama means without any desire. Now, without any desire means any material desire. We're meant to have this one desire, which is to please Krishna. But that's understood to be synonymous with nishkama, because kama means selfish desire. So such a devotee attains real peace because there's no misappropriation. And you see everything as the hand of the Lord in everything. So in other words, whether one is in a wealthy situation or a poor situation, dangerous situation or a secure situation, it's all a hand of the Lord. And you're seeing your karma being played out, your residual karma, or even better, you're seeing Krishna moving you around, you know, in these situations. And you don't try a material solution to any of your problems. You see? Just like Prahlad, you know? In the middle of this holocaust, if you will, of his father trying to kill him in all kinds of ways, he was simply in samadhi, peacefully thinking of Krishna within. And he was protected, completely protected. So that's that's how one can attain peace. That word is used there, shanti, shastradi, attains eternal peace. No others can attain it, those who recognize the Lord. So, Prabhupada takes, you know, great pains here. He's going at length about the essential, you know, first step to understand we are eternal persons, minute spirit souls, and that is our constitutional position. We can never become the infinite. And that's, you know, that sets up, that is allows us to always feel subordinate to the Lord as servants, you see. Otherwise, you become a competitor. You, as soon as you merge, or as soon as you feel you're a competitor to the Lord, your bhakti is finished. You know, we always have to feel that sense of insignificance. That's the basis of bhakti. If we graduate to a higher level, you can forget Krishna. You know, covers that, and you can feel one with the Lord. But that's on a very high level. The basis of all bhakti is this sense of service, feeling the Lord is very great. I'm very small. I'm dependent. You know, and I should serve Him eternally. That's kind of basic bhakti.
Also, there is no relationship or surrender or dependence if you are the one.
Right. If you're independent or if you feel that you're equal, you know, somehow.
So the Vedic statement, we say raso vaisa. So there is, you know, that narrow relationship is there. And so then there is no such thing. Then it's that
yeah.
as well. Because
and, you know, another verse, this is a main verse for combating the Mayavadis. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. Another was in chapter 7. Avyaktam vyaktam apanam manyate mama buddhiya. That the avyakta is the, you know, invisible, that stands for Brahman in this context. Vyaktam apanam has attained visibility. In other words, Krishna is a subordinate manifestation of Brahman. That's the theory of the Brahmins. They don't deny that Krishna exists or that he existed, But he's a subordinate manifestation. When you go beyond Krishna, or as our friend Dr. Radhakrishnan said, or you get to the unlimited, infinite within Krishna, then you've reached a higher reality. You see? But there's no higher reality than Krishna. And that takes us to another verse, probably. Very important. There is no existence greater than me, says Krishna in the seventh chapter. Everything is strung on me like pearls strung on a thread. You know, so that's, you know, there's no, that includes Brahman. Brahman is subordinate to Krishna. Yes.
Is it safe to say that the point of all these Upanishads describing the Supreme as impersonal is to attract people with the impersonal tendency? Is that the point? When I think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Because those books are supposed to be coming at the end of the Vedas, and they direct people what seems to be in an impersonal way. And then you have Bhagavad Gita that doesn't.
Yes, the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Gita Upanishad, which is the essence of all the Upanishads. Now, it's not all the Upanishads that emphasize Brahman. We have the Isha Upanishad, we have the Gopaltapani Upanishad, and here's the Katha Upanishad talking about the Isha. So if you find, you'll find, you know, but you don't have anything like the detail of the personality of Krishna, except in Gopaltapani, you do have some. Yeah. But the thing is that you have the emphasis on there, because this is what, as you say, you know, people were more attracted to. It gives you the focus of the Supreme, a way, and gives you a way of contrasting it with this material world. And if you read the Upanishads correctly, they also point toward the personal. It's not simply that they talk about Brahman. That emphasis on the Brahman as the Supreme, it's easier to get it from the Vedanta Sutra. Even that is ultimately personal. But then with the interpretation of Ashurika Bhashya, then you can come out with this impersonal realization.
I think my understanding is that Krishna as person does not want to be known through Vedas. He says, Naham Vedai. I'm not known through Vedas. So he wants to be known through a person, meaning a self-realized saint.
Bhakta.
Like Prabhupada. Yeah. That's why, you know, he leaves the Upanishads open to be interpreted. He leaves it kind of open. Like, so it could be interpreted another way, those who want to think of it like that. Because he's not putting his person into that thing. Because he wants to be known through a person. He's a person, known through a person, to a person.
But the interesting thing about it is that the Vedanta Sutra, which you could say is even more esoteric, you know, and open to different interpretation, that the real interpretation of that is the Bhagavatam, which is personal through and through, you know, and which really contains all the Upanishadic knowledge also in its proper perspective.
But that means Vedas by themselves do not reveal Krishna, but Vedas, when taught by a person who's the devotee, that reveals Krishna.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to the Bhagavad Gita, you're going to find Vedasya Sarva Aham Veda, by all the Vedas I am to be known.
Yeah.
But you're right, it has to be pointed out.
The person will give the right understanding or point
forward. I mean, ultimately, we come to the Bhagavatam, you know, as the crown jewel of all of the Vedas, as giving the right interpretation. There is a lot of mystery, and admittedly, you know, certainly as I was explaining, you know, if you come to these books without the teacher, it's very puzzling. What to speak of the Upanishads, even the Bhagavad Gita, is not, you know, it's very difficult to come to the conclusion of bhakti just on your own without the proper understanding. Yeah.
Then you can understand that. So, and Krishna wanted to leave things like that because he doesn't want to be per se in and of itself.
Hey, this is like Prabhupada says right in this purport, the non-devotee's approach to the teachings of the Gita is something like that of a bee licking down the bottle of honey. So the same thing could be said of all of the Vedas. The thing is, the human intelligence can like infinitely malleable, you know. And so many people will come; they'll see the same thing and describe it in so many different ways. So in a way, it's a way in which Krishna can remain hidden, because to the non-devotees, you know, in so many places, like in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Kaviraj says, well, I really, you know, I don't know if I should really write this. This is such a confidential. But it has to be told for the devotees. And the non-devotees won't be able to understand it anyway.
Anyway, yes.
And so it'll remain hidden in there. All right, let's go on to the next
one. And this is the reason why Krishna is also calling it Guhyam, and you know, it's Rahasyam, like it's confidential.
Yeah.
Why again? Because it's
a without the adhikari, the eligibility through some.
The idea is like one who is not, that means one who is a devotee.
Yeah, he mentions that in the fourth chapter. He refers to the fourth chapter here. That, what is it? Sayivaya maya tejo yoga prokta parat bhaktosi me sakacheti rahasyam me turutam. Rahasyam means the secret. So I'm speaking this to you today, Krishna says to Arjuna, because you're my devotee and my friend. And therefore, you can understand the secret of this.
Even the most technical chapter, if you look at the 13th chapter, which is the most technical, it's a riti kshetram tatha gyanam, geyam choknam samasata, mad bhakta etad vigya. Even there he's saying, this is in one sense, Upanishadic language, Upanishadic
right.
chapter, 13th
right.
chapter.
Right.
He's saying, even this, only my devotee can understand.
Yeah.
Mad havaya etad
vigya. All right, so let's become devotees so we can understand. Yeah.
I was just looking at the 15th chapter, and there's one verse in which Krishna says that he's the creator of the Vedanta itself.
Vedanta Krit. Veda.
Right, so this, like, it's all the facts, right? That
He's the creator, and he's also the goal of all the Vedas. He's right. the compiler of the Vedanta. Vyasadeva is also understood to be either expansion or certainly an empowered incarnation of Krishna. He explains it all.
Right.
But so the idea is that when we approach these things, it's how you approach it, you know, as to whether you can really understand it. Otherwise, it remains hidden. There's a covering there, and it seems to be open to interpretation this way, that way, and by that light, the real truth remains hidden. Let's go on. Next verse is very important. Prabhu, is it possible to sit on this side?
Huh?
Sit on this side.
Oh, on this side.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
You can take one of those.
Oh, we have a chair for you if you need.
Or you can sit in the chair.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Dehi nosmin yata dehe.
Dehi nosmin yata dehe.
Kaumarang yovanam jara.
Kaumarang yovanam jara.
Tatade hantara prapti.
Tatade hantara prapti.
Dhiras tatra namuhyati.
Dhiras tatra namuhyati.
As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Purport. Since every living entity is an individual soul, each is changing his body every moment, manifesting sometimes as a child, sometimes as a youth, and sometimes as an old man. Yet the same spirit soul is there and does not undergo any change. This individual soul finally changes the body at death and transmigrates to another body. And, since it is sure to have another body in the next birth, either material or spiritual, there was no cause for lamentation by Arjuna on account of death, neither for Bhishma, nor for Drona, for whom he was so much concerned. Rather, he should rejoice for their changing bodies from old to new ones, thereby rejuvenating their energy. Such changes of body account for varieties of enjoyment or suffering, according to one's work in life. So Bhishma and Drona, being noble souls, were surely going to have spiritual bodies in the next life, or at least life in heavenly bodies for superior enjoyment of material existence. So in either case, there was no cause of lamentation. Any man who has perfect knowledge of the constitution of the individual soul, the super soul, and nature, both material and spiritual, is called a dhira, or a most sober man. Such a man is never deluded by the change of bodies. The Mayavadi theory of oneness of the spirit soul cannot be entertained, on the ground that the spirit soul cannot be cut into pieces as a fragmental portion. Such cutting into different individual souls would make the supreme cleavable or changeable, against the principle of the supreme souls being unchangeable. As confirmed in the Gita, the fragmental portions of the supreme exist eternally, sanatan, and are called kshara. This is from a different part of the 15th chapter. That is, they have a tendency to fall down into material nature. These fragmental portions are eternally so, and even after liberation, the individual soul remains the same, fragmental. But once liberated, he lives an eternal life in bliss and knowledge with the personality of Godhead. The theory of reflection can be applied to the supersoul, who is present in each and every individual body and is known as the Paramatma. He is different from the individual living entity. When the sky is reflected in water, the reflections represent both the sun and the moon and the stars also. The stars can be compared to the living entities, and the sun or the moon to the Supreme Lord. The individual fragmental spirit soul is represented by Arjuna, and the Supreme Soul is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. They are not on the same level, as it will be apparent in the beginning of the fourth chapter. If Arjuna is on the same level with Krishna, and Krishna is not superior to Arjuna, then their relationship of instructor and instructed becomes meaningless. If both of them are deluded by the illusory energy, or maya, then there is no need of one being the instructor and the other the instructed. Such instruction would be useless because, in the clutches of maya, no one can be an authoritative instructor. Under the circumstances, it is admitted that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord, superior in position to the living entity Arjuna, who is a forgetful soul deluded by maya. So this verse is often the first verse that devotees memorize when they decide to memorize Bhagavad Gita verses. This is such a wonderful verse because anyone can, you know, just contemplate his own life and realize, yeah, it's true. That, you know, you don't have to be a great sage or scholar, or Vedic scholar, to just reflect on your own life and realize that actually it's true. I've had so many different bodies. You know, it's like because they've changed so slowly, you don't get that impression. But when you think back on it, you look at your old picture album, you can see that, you know, you had completely different bodies. And not just the external body, but also the subtle body, the mind. It's changed radically from day to day. So, and we are simply the knower, you know, as it says in the 13th, with Chaitragya. We know this field, both gross body and the subtle body field. It's changing at every moment. We're directing it, you know, the senses, and we are aware of that. So it's a big machine, you know, a yantra rudani maya. It is said that we're mounted on this machine made of the material energy in the 18th chapter, and we're going along, and Asada Buddha Prabhu, you know, so brilliantly explained. It's like this virtual reality machine, you know. We're not really seeing each other. We're seeing the external body of each other. We're not seeing the soul. We're seeing, you know, the way the soul acts through the body. And so, you know, we're all experiencing things differently because of how we associate with the modes of nature, because of our karma, because of our specific body. And everyone's going through this, you know, virtual experience. And it's radically different from birth to birth. Even if we do get a human body, you know, who knows where it'll be, what family will be in, what, you know, socioeconomic position, what our health will be, you know, radically different from one to another. What to speak of changing species? So this is really a, you know, the point to get from all this, you know, as Krishna says right here, one has to be dhira. One has to practice a yoga in such a way that you can keep your equilibrium or equipoise, as Prabhupada so often puts it, amongst all of these changes that are going on at every moment and that are unpredictable. You know, the tendency is to become conditioned and to think that tomorrow is going to be more or less like today. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, the earthquake comes and tomorrow is completely radically different. You may be in a different body or whatever, your situation is different. You know, or suddenly, you know, the report comes back from the doctor and you have some terminal disease, or someone who you love or know gets killed or died. There's always these shocks, you know. And then, you know, one has to be trained or get a training in yoga, you know, any bhakti yoga, some other, to be able to negotiate the shocks of this material world without becoming discombobulated. And that, so, you know, there is dhiras tatra namuyati. That one who is dhira means one who has some spiritual assets and practice can face death with equipoise, with calm. That's really what he's talking about here. It's not just that they're of course, the other thing is, in the context here, Arjuna is not upset about his own death. This is clear. He's upset about the death of his loved ones, you know, and those who he highly respects, like Drona and Bhishma. That, but that's all, that we also have to be dearer with that. That's another thing, you know. That can be, often be even more disturbing than our own death, or the prospect of our own death. So all, you know, it's very kind of dramatic here. You're dealing with absolute questions here. How to pass through this body in such a way that the different changes, including the final change, do not disturb you. So you can face death with equanimity and think of Krishna, you know, and not have to come back again for another term. This, you know, komaram yovanam jara, this is a painful progression. You know, each different age has its own challenges, and the older you get, the greater the challenges are, you know. And the great you know, power of Maya is to make you forget, to make you forget. And the lower down you are in the species, the more you forget from moment to moment. How can these trees, Prabhupada pointed this out, how can they stand being out there? You know, can you imagine standing? Prabhupada said, you get someone to, you know, just stand still, you know, with your arms up for a half an hour and see what, you know, how you can do it. You know, it used to be that we went out on Harinam, everyone had their hands up. Now, you can't do it anymore. You know, it's a bit of an austerity, you know. But you can imagine the tree, you know, like for weeks and years and, you know, decades at a time. And, you know, the cold and the heat and, you know, not enough water and then finally being chopped down and everything. And how could you live like that? We couldn't. But because the consciousness is so low, it's forgetting from moment to moment. You know, it's very, very covered consciousness. Basically just know, oh, the sun is up there. They can tell the sun, you know. Is there enough water? Yeah, it's coming through. Okay. You know, that's it. Otherwise, they get disturbed and they turn brown. You know, that's their reaction. That's all they can do. But you know, it's funny, but the thing is, it's really scary, you know, that we've been through that. Practically, we've come through all these species. And, you know, once again, oh, how fortunate we are to be human beings. We have a chance to end this process. But it's necessary, as Krishna will explain in subsequent verses, to become tolerant. Not just tolerant as, you know, sukha dukkha da. You know? In tolerance, we generally think, oh, I can tolerate the pain. But we have to tolerate the happiness, too. Without becoming disturbed. One has to become tatiksha of the allurements to happiness, because it's a two-sided coin. If you can't refrain from the allurements to, you know, gross sense pleasure, then it's sure and certain that you won't be able to tolerate the pain. They both go together. And if you cultivate some austerity in your life, then you'll be able to remain equal poised in the allurements. But of course, you really need to, in order to really become tolerant, you have to have some assets in Krishna consciousness. You have to be able to find that well of peace and well of happiness and joy within yourself, so that the externals won't bother you. You know. So that these two verses really go together. This 13:4. All the verses, you know, proceed from one to the other, but this particular verse is very telling. Anyone who reads this verse, it's like one of these where light bulbs go on. Yes, that is absolutely the truth. You can see how it's true. Yes.
To practice tolerance towards happiness and distress. Usually for me, sankirtan is pretty painful, but sometimes it's just total ecstasy. And I told this to Vrindavas, and he gave me some practical tips on how to be tolerant, to utilize that ecstasy for Krishna, even dance before the deities. Uh-huh. Do you have any like suggestions?
You sound like you have more than suggested. You know, it's almost like you build up your spiritual muscles. You know, just like if you, you know, I've never had a real regime where you, well, when I was a kid, I used to do it, you know, lift weight. Believe it or not, I used to lift weights, you know, 14, 15, and then become strong. So there's a burn, you know, like if you're running or something, you have some goal in mind, and then you have to get over a certain period of difficulty, and then it becomes easier. You become accustomed to it mentally and physically. You know, this is, of course, a physical thing we're talking about, external thing, material. But the idea of having a goal in mind, undertaking some difficult process to reach the goal, knowing that it will be effective because of what you've heard and seen others gone through, and then coming to that point where you have to overcome a certain physical pain or mental pain, emotional pain, you know, for the higher goal. And if you do it, you become stronger. And just like the good, even though it's difficult to go out and do it, then gradually, it's not such a difficult thing mentally. Just like I've had, this little thing. It's just something that I've done of taking on this near-jal fast every Ekadashi, which is kind of the standard thing. Now mentally, for many, many years, it was like a mental thing. No way, if you don't have to do it, I'm not going to do it, right? So, is it a half-day fast? Devotees would do all kinds of research. Did Prabhupada really say it's fast till dawn, till evening? Isn't there one point, one morning walk, where he said it's only fast till noon? It was like this whole thing, Whereas really, but if you mentally said, okay, this is it, I'm going to do it, you decide I'm going to do it, then maybe the first time it's a little more difficult, but after a while it's just something you do. And it's not that hard, So it's a question of practice. But the real key, as you were told, is to find that inner source, of Krishna consciousness. You're always praying and chanting, like Bhrigu, with his absorption, it's so good with the six Goswamis, You contemplate them in those verses, what they went through and what they were going through, and then you compare, what are we doing? They took on so much responsibility. It's not just that they underwent the difficulty of living under a tree and hardly eating and chanting Hare Krishna all the time, but they undertook huge projects, the writing of all these literatures and the excavation of the Lila Stali and the building of these temples for us, on Lord Chaitanya's behalf. And then when you see, what do we really have to go through? We have our little mini austerities, so it helps you. You gain strength. You gain strength by hearing about the great devotees who have gone before, contemplating Prabhupada's life, and contemplating the devotees who underwent so much austerities for Prabhupada, starting temples, risking lives, and doing all these things, preaching in the Muslim countries when no one else was, then it gives you spiritual strength to go through, and gradually you build up. This sort of. All right, I just want to run through this purport and make sure we didn't miss anything. So then there's the argument, because it's always an argument. Krishna, it's pointed out that, okay, now the assumption is here that it's dharmic. In other words, that Arjuna is fighting for the right cause here. And therefore, why should he lament for Bhishma and Drona? Because they'll be killed. You won't be committing any sin because you're fighting for the right cause. And they'll be getting new lives. They'll be getting new bodies, So what's the problem? If you're fighting on the sinful side, then, it's very bad. Anyone you kill on the other side, especially such great souls as Bhishma and Drona, that'll just pile up on your sin. In the 18th chapter, very important verse, where Krishna says, if you're doing something free of false ego, even up to the point of killing someone, then there's no sinful reaction. But what does it mean that it's free of false ego? Not that you're doing it for the greater good of the United States or this or that, but you're doing it for Krishna. You're doing it for God. Without any doubt. Now, of course, some may claim this is for God, this is God, this is a holy war. And that can be, just as sinful. But here, there's no question about it. The whole background of the Mahabharata and how they were cheated out of their kingdom, and Krishna is Dharma personified, and Yudhisthira is also Dharma personified. So there's no question that this is a righteous war. It's a right thing to do. And if it's fought, if Arjuna fights, it's complete auspiciousness. Just the opposite of what he was calculating on the material platform. He had quoted the Vedas. He wasn't just pulling it out of his head. He was quoting the Vedas, to justify what he wanted to happen, which was that he wouldn't have to kill his relatives. This is a very, telling instance, because just like it said, that saying is even the devil can quote scripture, So of course Arjuna's not the devil, don't get me wrong. But the idea is that if you approach these books with a material motivation, then you can pull anything out of it. Prabhupada talks out, Gandhi, you know, he used to be a follower of Gandhi. But, you know, he said, you can pull out of this, it's a politician, that there's some political thing here. And you can say, oh, this symbolizes this, this symbolizes this. Some try to pull out nonviolence from the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the Bhagavad Gita contains that. That's an element of knowledge that appears several times. But it's not the point. It's not the goal of the Bhagavad Gita. I like to tell this story. I came in contact, I think it's the Transcendental Meditation people, or maybe some other group. They only have the Gita up to the sixth chapter. And they were, that's it. The sixth chapter is the final instruction. And one fellow told me, I think reading the fourth chapter, this was another group, this is the secret teaching of the Gita. This verse here, the one about the pranayama, offering the outgoing breath and the ingoing yama. And they built a whole, you know, who knows, they built a whole movement on basis. So if you don't have the right teacher and interpreter, then you're going to come up empty-handed, you know, in this Gita. So there's no question, you know. So in this case, the killing of the these great souls will be an auspicious thing. They will get renewed body, and you know, Yudhishthira will be enthroned.
Plus, you cannot take Gita in parts because, like, Arjuna is accepting sarvam etam etam etam. You take the whole.
Yes, yes. Purpose. Otherwise, you have the famous half-hand logic. Ardha kukriti nyaya. You know the ardha kukriti nyaya. Yeah. Half-hand logic.
I know.
It means that. And it's often applied to Shastra. It was also applied to Krishna's Kaviraj when his brother, he had a high regard for Lord Chaitanya, but he didn't have regard for Lord Nityananda, you know, because he saw Nityananda as an avaduta, you know, Lord Chaitanya was a perfect sannyasi or whatever. I think it was, anyway, so Krishna thought it was chastising. You can't, you know, respect one without respecting the other. They're like brothers, you know, they're... And so, due to his good qualities, this is from the CC, of chastising his brother, Nityananda appeared to me in a dream and told him to go to Vrindavan. You'll find everything there. And the next morning he woke up, he left home and went to Vrindavan, and he became Krishna's Kaviraj. He wrote the Govinda Lilamrita early on, and later on, of course, the Chaitanya Charitamrita. You know. What were you going to ask? Let's say.
So I can explain it properly in books. Can you give a very concise reason why this is the most authoritative version of Bhagavad Gita? Srila Prabhupada is the best.
It's not a mystery. The reason is this: is that, but the Bhagavad Gita, you know, like many spiritual books, Bhagavad Gita deals with matters that are beyond our immediate ken. You know, we have these four defects. Prabhupada mentions that in the previous verse, purport. So when you're dealing with spiritual matters, you know, the soul is amazing. You know, some hear about them and they say, you can't see the soul, you can't measure it, you can't taste it, you know. What to speak of God, you know. This is why the atheists, you know, they rail away. What is this, you know, this superstition, that's cast it away. This is the age of science, you know. You know what I mean? Because so it's all very mysterious. And in order to access that which is beyond our mind and senses, we need a source of knowledge that's superhuman, that's beyond the limitations. You know, it's as simple. Now, some may claim, you know, on the basis of their own minds and senses, that there is no such source like that. These are your, you know, down, you know, hardcore atheists and skeptics, you know. And they've taken over the education system. This whole, you know, railing against creationism. Okay, it's not creationism, it's just intelligent design. You know? Oh, that's just a cover for creationists. You know, we know that's hardcore Christianity. You know, everyone knows evolution is true. You know? And this is the greatest darkness to think that this, you know, some God created everything. But you know, I mean, even... To me, just it's such a simple logical thing to see. You know, a child can see that everywhere you look, there's organization. There is. How can you say it? It's a perfect phrase. Intelligent design. You know, and where there's intelligent design, there's intelligent designer. Now they can come up with their far out arguments. How you know you with infinite time in the universe and infinite universes, anything can happen. You know, you put a million monkeys in a stadium somewhere, or however many will fit in there, give him a keyboard, you know, and a printer, you know, and a computer, and eventually they'll type out the Shakespeare, they'll type out Bhagavad Gita. Right. Yes, you know, with an infinite amount of time and an infinite amount of monkeys and an infinite amount of gigabytes, sure. Therefore, we don't need God. But which makes more sense? That there actually is an intelligent person who is controlling, or that there's two, you know, 100 billion, quadrillion universes, and this is the only one where everything worked just right, and here we are sitting here thinking about how wonderful.
Shakespeare gave me his
funny that you say the monkey, because they don't account for the time and the paper and the typewriter. You know, people say monkey, typewriter, Shakespeare, but the time that you need to give the monkeys, that is a fourth dimension they never, you know, put into the
I know.
It,
in other words, it's like, we'll do anything. We'll come up with any theory, you know, just to avoid God, you know. It's right here in the Gita.
Fanatism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I forget, what were we dealing with, the question? Oh yes, why the authority? So, why this Gita? Yeah. Okay. So the idea is that any secret knowledge that there exists, if you have the person who wrote the knowledge, or you have a person who is very close friends with the person who knows the secret, then that's the person who can give you the real truth. Otherwise, you know, you can try on your own to figure this out, but it will remain opaque to you, because it's not subject. Especially if it's very personal knowledge. How can you force someone, you know, to tell you their intimate secrets? You can't. But if they're their intimate friend, then they'll reveal in proportion to how, you know, you are close to them. So that's what we have here. This Bhagavad Gita, which is Bhagavad Gita as it is, has been given to us by a great saint, a devotee, who is intimate with Krishna, the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita. So now Prabhupada, you know, he realizes very well that this is, you know, people could say, yeah, but how do you know there even is a Krishna? So therefore, in order to get this knowledge, to benefit from it, at least theoretically, you have to accept that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And you know, there's no question that Srila Prabhupada was his devotee, you know. So that's one of the ways. And then the other thing is there's an urgency to it. Because someone would say, yeah, okay, that's good for you, but I got other things to do. So, and they, millions of people do say that. But here's the point, here's the urgent point, is that we have a problem, right? We all have these problems, the threefold miseries. First thing you have to do is convince someone that we're on the battlefield with Arjun. We have an urgent problem that we have to solve, and that is birth, old age, disease, and death. By remaining doubtful, you're cast upon the water. You don't solve your problem, you know? In other words, but this is a book and a knowledge that at least claims to give you a means to solve the problem. So isn't it worth investigating on its own terms, you see? In other words, spend a little time with it and with the process that it recommends, and then, you know, associate with those who are on the path and see if it doesn't make sense that this can solve the essential problems of life. This is as far as you can go. You know, you can't really prove until someone is associating, but it at least makes sense that way. I'm sorry, we've gone over. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.